Okay, thank you, Sara. And so this, my talk is going to be less formal than Ilya, but probably more esoteric, as you will see. First of all, I want to acknowledge my collaborators. We don't have any wet lab or any sort of biological lab. It's all computation and theory. So my collaborators provide all the data and also the discussions, of course. So my focus, as Sara said, is been lately on fMRI in particular, because it's such a unique technique to understand function in the brain with all the limitation that it has. The background of this is that most of the work that you see is essentially predicated upon very simple linear models. You do something, some stimulus, then you look at each voxel and you find a correlation, and that's typically where it ends. Essentially, all the internal relationships that are present in the brain and might be present in the data are thrown away. And so the question is, can we say something more about the signal? In particular, we were thinking of, well, you know, can we cast this in the context of network theory and construct networks that are statistically relevant given the signal that we have? More importantly, and more, you know, more of a challenge, can we say something meaningful about functional information? That's the really tough question. I think I'll give you only sort of hand-waving answers for that one. So I'm going to be telling you of the work that we've been doing in order to extract, analyze, model, and eventually interpret these networks that are based on functional MRI data. And but before proceeding, you have, you know, the same similar problem as Ilya was describing. We have around 30,000 voxels over a number of maybe 100 to 1,000 time points. You can have even more. So everything you do is pretty challenging from a computational point of view. So the first thing that we did was extremely simple. We just took the data, the, you know, evolution, the time trace of each voxel, computed a cross-correlation with every other voxel, apply a threshold, you get the network, you can start playing with it. And what we saw was, in a way, encouraging, interesting. We found several hallmarks of statistical regularities. In particular, the connectivity of the networks are scale-free, so you know, the degree is the distribution is a power law, and that's pretty robust to the threshold that you use. In principle, we use an arbitrary threshold, high threshold, but arbitrary. And what is interesting is that this is true not only for the same subject and the different conditions, as long as there is some condition and there's activity in the brain, but it's also true across subjects. Again, you know, going back to the second question, the interpretation of this is not clear to us, but you know, it's a very strong regularity. The other thing is that the networks are atypical in the way that most biological networks are hierarchical. So if you look at the degree and of a node and then the degree of the first neighbor, typically you expect an inverse relationship. And when we don't find that, we cannot claim that, you know, there is exactly the opposite direction, but there is no trace of hierarchy in the network that we extract. Again, interpretation, you know, we cannot say anything about it. Yeah. So this is average degree of first neighbors, given that you have, you know, a node, you look at the first neighbors. This is one way of looking at that, whether there is some trace of hierarchy in the network. So typically, you know, many biological networks have an inverse. So high degree means that your neighbors are, you know, are not half. So you're half, your neighbors are not. No, well, here we'll talk about that. So this is pairwise correlation symmetric. We'll talk about that.
So I presume that when you talk about pairwise correlation,
It's pretty, yes, the mean is pretty constant. Well, overall, the signal has very small variation. Yeah, but the mean is. No, because we'll go back the network. So you end up with this spaghetti soup. That there are ways of comparing this with the traditional approaches, and what we find is functional network, functional areas. So I'll go back a little bit, but yeah. Yeah, I take every voxel and I compare. Yeah, we didn't. Yeah. Oh, the temporal resolution, we use networks. We corroborated these four networks with temporal resolution of 1 second up to 3 seconds. The spatial resolution is the typical spatial resolution, is 2 to 3 millimeters per side. Right? There's no in this sense, at least, just in the sense that if you do with the other measures, clustering, but this is very simple, just the degree and the number of neural networks. So typically, the internet, for instance, is exactly like, or the web, exactly like this. Right? So the big hubs are connected to small hubs. The New York Times connected to very small.
How do you reconcile your skills with the area of the brain and the anatomy
of the brain? Oh, okay. It's an indirect.
All your boxes are typically in G1, for example?
No, no, no. We can show the networks. Let me see, right here. Yeah, correlation coefficient. That's right. That's right. I'll talk about directed later.
Whatever you do is going to come out of the same, if the network is big enough, or is there some room?
Well, I cannot answer that question. I can tell you the little bit that we learned in the context of looking for directionality in the links. And that what the lesson is, we believe what the lesson is. So the other thing is that we find is that, small world topology, so the clustering, the density of triangulations is pretty high compared to an Erdős network. And the path, the mean geodetic path is comparable. So, it has the same properties as other biological networks. So, like you see here, it's also pretty robust. High thresholds, 0.6 to
0.9.
Right. No, by Erdős, I mean a network that has no structure where you just throw the links, you have the nodes and throw the links at random. Right, so typically, your degree will be some Gaussian around the mean number of total edges over top and over nodes. You're gonna get something like this.
In
the centrum, it's very small, very, very, very extremely small.
Right.
That you're gonna have a triangle, right? But the path, given that you have many shortcuts, the path is small. So this is degree, this is the count. This is the degree of the nodes. Okay, so this, well, this is, you know, this is true for any task that, that we see. Because this is very, you know, very general. It might be related to what Ilya was saying. That this is very, very robust, which means that from a functional point of view, it's not very useful. that's a problem. And precisely to address that, we sort of designed a Lismuth test. And essentially, we said, well, we should be able to pick up subtle differences in brain states, something that, the linear model cannot do. And what we have here is someone doing self-paced finger tapping like this. And you have a cue to start and a cue to stop. You have a second, very small cue, very short cue. And in the case, you have a large visual cue, an auditory cue, or a small visual cue. And so this is one of the questions. So one way to depict these networks, which is incomplete because you are throwing away information, is and we are doing this because it looks like the linear map. Color code the density, the degree of the nodes. Right? So if I have a node with 1,000 connections, I color code that, and I represent partially the network by doing this. Of course, I'm throwing away where the edges are, but you know, in order to compare to the linear analysis, that's something relatively reasonable. And you see that there are similarities and differences between the linear analysis and the hub analysis, like for instance the motor cortex and somatosensory cortex. That's pretty prominent in both cases. Now, going back to the Lismuth test, we could not see any difference. So the linear analysis cannot pick up differences between these three conditions. The hub analysis it cannot do that either. So we thought, well, you know, these networks that don't have enough correlation or enough distributed power. So the natural train of thought is, well, maybe what we need to do is capture more of the dynamics of the system. But the problem that you run into is that you have, you know, 10,000 variables, 30,000 variables. So what the first thing that we thought of doing is going to compute delay correlations, and that I'm going to explain that in a moment. The other thing that, if I have time, I hope to describe to you is the Granger approach, where essentially you try to get at some formal definition of causality, and it's called whatever, the Granger causality, and then identify the links based on that. But also it has the problem that scales, the computation of these scales quadratically with the size of the number of nodes. So what we did first, so in order again to sort of somehow capture more of the internal dynamics of the system, is compute instead of just the correlation coefficient, which is, you know, the correlation at zero lag, compute the correlation with a lag, and see if there is a significant correlation at some lag, and the lags are going to be small, of course, in general, just two or three, at most three times in the past or in the future. So with that, what we do is define a directed edge. So whenever, you know, one precedes two. Sorry? So like I said, it's between 1 second and 3 seconds. So there's a huge number of phenomena that you will never see. But we know that the signal is a convolution with the you know, blood response, which has a time constant of 6 seconds. So there are, and this has been something that we've been fighting with the people in the brain imaging community, because until recently nobody believed that there was information in time, but there is information in time. We are not just saying that. I mean, you have to be careful and have to compute it. But now, whenever you have a delay correlation, you have a directed edge. whenever the correlation is strong at zero lag, then you have an undirected edge, so you end up with a hybrid network of directed and undirected edges. And what is interesting with this is that now you can get at some of the problems that you have typically with correlation. That, for instance, a typical artifact is that you have correlation between two or three because you have a common source. Right. So there are many of these artifacts that and that's why people have tried other approaches, in particular with small number of areas to get a sort of true causality. But without going to that, at least for now, we can get rid of some of these artifacts. In particular, if we find this configuration with a common source, we typically excise that link, assuming that it's because of a correlation because of a common source. We can look at higher order structures like this. We can identify them. The problem is that with this, we excise between 10 and 20% of the undirected edges, which is significant. Here, we find just only very few. And again, clearly, we are bumping against the temporal resolution of the technique. So obviously, there might be many more like this, but we just cannot see them. So what happens with this now is that we recover the same universal properties instead of scale-free connectivity. Now we have different exponents for the distribution of degree for undirected edges and for the directed edges as well. We also have a non-hierarchical small world topology, but we start to get some insight into function. In principle, the first thing that we saw is that just the diameter, so the average minimal path between two nodes is different in the two conditions. Now we can separate the conditions based on the topology. We can go back and see that if you look at the outcuts, so just looking at the outlink, there is significant differences in the density of the outcuts between the two conditions in specific areas that include, for instance, the cerebellum. This is average across the subjects, so we can pick up these differences in the two conditions over the subject. And plotting here essentially the boxes where there is a significant difference in the density of out connections. Okay. What happens is that, and I didn't plan to show it because of lack of space and time. The neutral links don't change, and in the condition. So there are the neutral links are pretty much the same, and they are sort of, in our interpretation, the ongoing activity of the brain as seen by fMRI, and that's, I think, why we have these sort of universal properties of scaling and clustering and diameter. It's only when you look at this directionality that you can pick up differences, small differences, which are essentially small differences in the brain function anyway, because between finger tapping with one cue and another, the differences are small. But it looks like we can begin to pick up these differences, and to some extent make some sense. It's difficult to even to describe this to. No, we are hoping to do that. We're going to get soon, hopefully, simultaneous fMRI EEG. The difference, the problem is different because you can play with techniques that you cannot play with here. So here you have 30,000 voxels, at most 1,000 points. With the other techniques, you have at most 100, 120, and you have as many samples some time as you want. So we're going to get our hands on that data. We still don't know what to do, but okay. So what is next? And just give you a hint of the kind of thing that we are doing. We thought that this kind of technique is particularly relevant to study complex psychiatric diseases where it's not very easy to find some external correlate, you know, some particular stimulus that will bring about a difference between the normal and the patient. That is more, you know, sort of intrinsic activity that is disrupted. So we developed a parallelized algorithm to find motifs, because now that you have these hybrid networks, you have the higher richness of possible configuration. And you know, it's feasible in terms of computation using, you know, a mini cluster, for instance. The other thing that we've been doing is use precisely this possibility of having these complex and interesting networks to do some modeling. And for several reasons, we first focused on cycles as one of the possible, of all the possible topological configurations. And what we saw in these networks that we identified with this technique is that the cycles tend to be anticorrelated. When you look at the edges tend to be anticorrelated, which, you know, given all the preprocessing and all the assumptions of this indirect measure that fMRI is, it's not so easy to claim that, you know, this is truly a big finding. However, we find a similar thing in many other biological techniques, biological networks that I'm going to describe now, which lends a bit more credibility to what we see. So the way, you know, you still have if you look for topological patterns in cycles that you identify in these networks, you still have a wide variety of possible equivalence classes. So we decided, for simplicity, to summarize the complexity of the topological structure of a cycle into something that, you know, appeals to us physicists, which is the magnetization. Essentially, if you have a cycle like this, you assign an arbitrary direction, and then you count spins up, spin down, and then you take the absolute value of that, and you summarize the cycle by that. So what we saw is that you have this strange structure. So these are the functional networks that I just described. They have many neutral links. So the neutral links will count as zero. And these are, you know, just a host of different networks, signaling networks in CA3, E. coli, yeast, food web, which is the one that we know exactly all the places are. This food web in the lake, a complete closed ecosystem. We have our brain functions. We have the C. elegans structure, and we have always this, you know, this serrated structure here, which essentially is telling us that whenever you have an even number of edges, you can always, or almost always, accommodate all of them so that the edges cancel. Whenever you have an odd, there will always be one that's standing out. So essentially, this is telling us that the cycles tend to be highly anti-correlated and trying to cancel any possible feedback loop that you see. And this is also the case for some technological networks, with only one exception that we found, which is a network defined by the FAA as preferred routes from airport to airport. And this is significant because we will see, I think, that helps us to explain possibly what's going on. So, you know, being physicists, and, you know, Ilya already talked about something similar. You know, we like to cast everything into the ISIN model. And so essentially what we want to do, what we wanted to do here is to say something more statistically meaningful about the organization that we see. So we can recast the cycles into a circular ISIN system with a single parameter, the energy exchange J. But given that we have many neutral links, we have to account for that as well. So we need a chemical potential that will account for links that, in this formulation, we have seen, you know, the value will be zero. So that, you know, it has a name. It's, you know, we found later that someone did something like that. So we can compute the magnetization and fit the best J and mu for our network. And what we see is that we have a pretty nice plot. Pretty nice fit for all of the networks. And in all of the cases, you have a negative J. So it's essentially they're saying you have anti-ferromagnetic configuration. So exactly, you know, in this framework, in this statistical framework of the ISIN model, you have a negative interaction, a consequence of which is, like I said, you know, you have a sort of depletion of feedback loops. And the only exception is, like I said, the FAA. And the FAA is, of all these networks, is the only one for which there is some sort of local conserved quantity. It is not exact, because it was not designed to be exact, but, you know, the number of airplanes is a proxy for a conserved quantity. Yeah. It is oscillating a bit, but, you know, the fit still is anti-ferromagnetic. If you look at only the directed edges, then the fit is perfect. So the neutral edges make the fit a bit more difficult. If I remove the neutral edges, you know, the fit is really almost perfect. Almost, and I will see. You know, I'll show you the other possible source of differences. So, like I said, you know, the fact that the FAA is the only one with some sort of conserved quantity points to the idea that maybe this is just a local phenomenon, and nothing really related to the structure of the network or anything like that. And to some extent, it is. So it's a bit difficult, but I struggle with the representation. This seems to be the only representation that really works. What we find is an exclusion principle. So the hubs tend to be either out hubs or in hubs. And this is one way to represent this. So here, we're representing the absolute value between the in degree and the out degree, the difference. And here, I'm representing the maximum between the in degree and the out degree. So if the exclusion principle was perfect, then you would see just a straight line here. And this is pretty much what you see. It's not perfect. And, you know, it completely breaks down for the FAA. So it is true that this seems to be, what we see seems to be just a local phenomenon, but it's not the complete story. And to do that, we resort to the common technique of shuffling the edges. So you can do a very restricted partial shuffle or a Maslow. It's called the Maslow shuffle. So you preserve the local information, the number of edges and nodes, but locally the number of out links and the number of in links is exactly preserved. It's just that randomize the targets and the sources, of course. So even if you do that, you see that the magnetization is higher if you don't constrain by in and out. So you just preserve the total number of links, but you could have more or less in or out degrees per node. Of course, you even have more magnetization. So in all cases, in all sorts forms of randomization, where you preserve the local information, what happens is that magnetization increases. So the number of another way to say this is the number of feedback loops also increases. So besides just the local information, there are architectural patterns that are present here that minimize even further the number of these configurations, which we can call feedback loops. And you know, I don't have time. We have some indications what the structures are. And we can think of this as sort of an extension of work that has been done in other networks by Uri alone, where they find something similar for configurations of three nodes. But essentially, we are extending this to bigger loops, at least, and to other networks. So, our is it okay? So, yes. Briefly, just to mention a couple more things. Clearly, given that we are looking at so many different networks, for some of which we don't know what the type of interactions are. For some, we do, like in the food web. The only thing that we thought is common in all these networks is that they have a dynamics. And you know, at least in the case of the food web, we know what the dynamics is. So it's almost obvious, but you have to show it, and we did show it, that the networks, the real networks, are more stable or you know less noisy than any other randomization. So one obvious consequence of this pattern is that the dynamics of networks is very different from what you would expect from any other less structured configuration. And the Granger, I don't have some time to talk about the Granger analysis, but you know, in a nutshell, we using a sort of generalized Granger analysis, we can discriminate between normal people and schizophrenic people with a very simple task, which is listening to speech. But this is based on a sort of massive machine learning analysis of all the features, of the network features that we identify. In the process of trying to understand, you know, how to go back to function and say, you know, these differences are because of specific functional differences between the groups. But you know, it's encouraging that we can discriminate based on network features between normals and schizophrenia. So that covered like five slides. And yeah, I'll stop here then. Well, we're still, you know, our current hypothesis, and this seems to be borne out by the kind of features that you know the machine learning technique extracts as more relevant, is that you have there's no difference in the overall you know number of edges and nodes, etc. What it seems to be that you have isolated islands of activity. So when a normal you have sort of a giant component. For a given threshold, the network comes up as a giant component where pretty much everyone is connected to everyone. In the case of the schizophrenic, what you have is a similar number of nodes, but in islands, you know, you have like, instead of one, you have 40 different components. That's right. Fragmented topology, I can't tell you anything about, you know, the geometry, but the topology seems to be fragmented. But, you know, when you use machine learning, it's difficult to interpret. But it seems to be, we are testing whether that interpretation is correct. Yeah, so, okay, I'll stop here then.